Hello.
Hi. It worked.
Marcy, is that you?
Yes, it
Okay, great. Just a minute. Feel free to move closer if you like. That is a blue light sign. Sleep hygiene thing.
Don't come over to me. I know she's got a few minutes left.
Okay, no worries. We can wait about 5 minutes. Start. I'm rarely on time, so I would. If people are okay with that. Well, we will have a unit on that at some point on Seder order. Yeah. Just for the record, we'll just only the group.
Last time the recording.
So I'll text the Ertas and see if I can get her on the line too.
Who? What?
I'll text B.
B's on the line.
B.
B's here.
Oh, okay.
I think she's here. Yes, B, can you hear us?
She on the phone?
Yeah, her name is popping up for me.
Oh, okay. I don't see it. Maybe I do. Yes, I see it. She's turned the video off.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Oh, is that speaker?
Cool.
Or the chat.
Before we begin, does anyone need a packet? To start us, we'll wait 2 minutes, we'll wait till 5 hours.
Pretty good. That's yeah. Yeah. That's always an aspect of trying to fit it in. Yeah. How about you? I know exactly. Right? It's going to spread out. It's going to be here. Yeah.
Usually, there's one to your shoulder.
Ah, okay. Someone is joining us on the phone. Someone new. Who are you?
Hi, it's Ruth.
Who is it?
Ruth.
Ruth. Welcome, Ruth.
It's great to have you with
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we'll begin. I'm glad we waited 5 minutes. And I think we'll start. So we'll start the VOD. So we always start the VOD with something contemplative. I think a nigun, feeling a nigun tonight. Does anyone have a favorite nigun they would like? Maybe just because it's Erev Yom Kippur, you know, in the literature, Erev Yom Kippur is a significant day. The Torah says, in the ninth in the evening, when describing Yom Kippur, and the Talmud learns from that that anyone who eats on the ninth, ready the ninth of Tishrei, the Torah counts as if you fasted on the ninth and the tenth. So what a lot of the, particularly the Hasidim and the Kabbalists learn from that, so the ninth is a holiday. It's like a two-day holiday. There's the ninth, the Erev Yom Kippur, and the tenth, the fast. There's the eating day and the fasting day. A lot of things to say about that. I'm going to see none of them. But given that, and it's sort of a quasi-festival day, perhaps we'll enter into the Yom Kippur spirit of Nigunim, which is an interesting one. Maybe with the nigun for Emet Man Nehedar, Haya Kohen Gadol. Behold, how wondrous the high priest was, leaving the Holy of Holies in the service to enter this space. You can consider it like a Kodesh Kedashim of sorts. We'll be doing the opposite. We'll be entering as opposed to leaving. So it's a nice nigun, originally written by a British school choir. It's become very famous, though. Do 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 da ba 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 It's a good song because the words are they would leave Bishalom Bulit Vega with in peace without any flaws. And obviously, we have no flaws. Tikkun Midot, we're all human. But perhaps it's relevant in some other context as well. So I'll enter into Anava, humility. Just one housekeeping note. Almost everyone has a chavruta or study partner, except for three people. That's because I was left with three, but there are two who are maybe going to join starting today, and I was waiting. So if you're one of those three people who doesn't have a study, we will have a partner before you leave tonight. I think it's you. Might be someone else. Anyone else without a study partner here? What? Bechira is the second one in the unit.
Oh, see.
But we're going to rely on that. It's more a little more of a background in a sense, a little bit more than a full unit. It's more like a concept I wanted people to have knowledge of. So we'll just review that. We learned two terminologies in the past session. And I'm acknowledging the holidays are kind of breaking this up a little bit, but that's okay. We're going to keep pushing forward. So we dealt with the concept of Hitzlamdut and Bechira. So who would like to remind the group, what is the concept of Hitzlamdut? And if people could say their name before they speak, just in case folks don't know each other, eventually we'll drop that. But Hitzlamdut, anyone remember what that was?
Adam, that's like an openness to learning?
An openness to learning, right, an openness to learning. Looking at things and instead of kind of judging or being willing to learn from things. And so it's kind of a stance or an outlook that's important in the Musar. Anyone else want to add anything about that? Okay. And the other kind of term that we dealt with in the last class, that's sort of a background fundamental term, was Nekudat HaBechira, the Bechira point or choice point. And what is that? Like to refresh our memory. Yeah.
Also, Adam. like I said, the point of free will, which you can go either way.
Right. And so, like for example, most people are not tempted here by being like serial killers. It's not complicated not to murder people each night, I assume. but there are things which are complicated. And so, wherever you're at the point where sometimes you succeed and sometimes you do not succeed, right? Like, for many people, it can be like controlling their anger at a moment of indignation or other different things. So that's where that is your Nekudat Bechira. That's your choice point at this moment. It's not things that are very easy for you or things that are so far away from achievable that you'll never get there. It's the very place of struggle. And that becomes, so these two concepts are very important in Musar. Before we delve into the next unit, did anyone want to say anything about practice with them? We had sort of a twofold practice which we'll have for each unit. That's to have a focus phrase that you try and say again and again, and also a Kabbalah, something you're trying to do, a simple, achievable, measurable task you're trying to do each day that furthers the sort of the thing. Karen, you're raising your hand.
I am.
Okay.
It worked great for the first week, a little bit less great for the second week, and by the last week, I was not doing it either.
Okay, so we started strong. We started strong. Karen said it worked great the first week, the second week a little less, but the third week I was no longer doing it. A common occurrence in this thing. so common, in fact, that some Moser Vaz meet every 2 weeks for that very reason, specifically for that reason. We're not going to do that. Now that we have chavrutas, hopefully if you're able to establish a regular pattern, sort of accountability to the chavruta is one of the things that might remedy that. But that's like everything in life that we do that we try and commit to. We could start off strong and then kind of fade. So we'll just acknowledge and name that. And hopefully the chavruta will be an antidote. Welcome, Sally. It's great to have you. But if not, journaling can also help. If we establish a fixed time each day to journal about it, even if the journaling goes something like, I forgot about this all day, and here I am with you, journal. That's fine. It's just an accountability recollection to
what
sort
was
of...
What was our daily Kabbalah that we were supposed to do? I thought it was just being mindful of learning.
Yeah, so Hitzlamdut was a little... unlike the others. So it'll, in the sense that it was learning daily from a particular thing, in this case.
But it wasn't taking on something to...
Right. Whereas in the other units, it's going to be a little more tangible. So I think that will probably help. Anyone else have anything they want to add before we jump into humility?
I think it would be a suggestion. I think it would be a good idea if there were reminders. I mean, maybe from you or from other people in the group that there could be, I don't know if we're all on a group email, where there could be a little bit more of a conversation between these months. Because certainly from last month to this month, I mean, then we didn't get our partners to.
Yeah.
It really didn't.
It's disconnected. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we could do two things then. I'm hearing that. So you'll have partners. So hopefully that will help. But would folks like for me to create a Google group for this group where people could share as they wanted? Hey, I came across this interesting experience with no pressure to share. Or are people feeling like more email? So the partner, twofold. Part of it will be text study and study of material, but then part of it will be kind of like personal check-in to say, like, how am I doing with this Kabbalah that I've taken? That would hopefully be on a weekly basis.
I think that could, I mean, that could act as one reminder.
I could also send out a daily reminder.
I'm down for a Google group if people want
to. I could, sure.
Google group, I feel like, always works because those people that don't want to pay attention just won't. Right? So.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead. Let me know if you want to opt out of the Google group. I'm going to create a Google group, and this way I'll send out instructions. And if you want to write to the group and share an experience or ask a question or you saw a great source or a meaningful thing happened, it's a good way to share. And also, I will send out a daily something. A daily something. You'll get a daily something.
I can do it on a WhatsApp group line also.
Yeah, I'm thinking a Google group if that's okay. That's going to be easy.
Google would be the best because you can do whatever on Google. But you can create a discussion, you can form your own chat. I'm sure you can upload a video or something. If you're,
okay, we will have a Google group, a group Google group, and that will be nice. We can also accumulate material together. I'll create a shared folder as well that people have access to. So if people want to see texts or other things that people are writing in, you can put it into the folder. So we'll all have access to the Google group and the team drive. That's what we'll call it.
Team drive.
Okay. Good suggestions. Now we're going to move on to Anava and humility. And I thought that it would actually be helpful for us to sort of maybe study, since this is a manageable group size, to study the initial or introductory essay as a group. But before we start, I wanted to take stock of what people think humility means, or anava, either Jewishly or just broadly. What is anava, humility? Who is humble? Do you have an example of someone in your mind who is humble? Is it you?
I think of different aspects. I guess one thing that I think of is acknowledging and appreciating one's strengths and purpose without necessarily boasting and taking credit.
Uh-huh. So appreciating, this was a good working definition, actually. Appreciating one's strengths without taking credit or boasting.
Or needing to take credit.
Or without needing to take credit. Say more about that. Why? Because what would be wrong with needing to take credit for your wonderful accomplishments?
Yeah, just feeling like you need that.
Assurance.
Yeah, you're not comfortable and you need it rather than, because I think it's okay to take credit for things. You know, like think of the other side, not necessarily be obnoxious about it, but to take credit. So it's just dream of, or just
demanding credit.
Can you hear virtually? Can you all hear?
Not feeling like you're better,
not really. Like
you're better because of something you know you've done or you are.
So Allison was talking about not needing to take credit. As it were, because of like who you are. So it's not just about taking credit or not, but sort of the like psychological need to take credit for things.
I'll add a couple words to that and say not feeling the need to take credit.
Jan would add, in addition to not needing to take credit, not feeling the need to take credit. And so I will ask a question to the group. Why do you sometimes, we all feel the, I think, feel sometimes the need to take credit or get credit for things. Maybe you don't. I do. So why? Why?
Well, not to exaggerate the
need. Not to exaggerate the need.
Not exaggerate that feeling of needing to feel.
I'm trying to get to the underlying thing.
We
like
want
what?
To feel appreciated. There's nothing that we that. Want to feel appreciated. So we're doing and doing and giving and giving and giving. And see to our children, and then there's no gratitude coming back or no appreciation. Then. I mean, okay. At some point, it's nice to get something back.
It makes us feel useful. It makes you feel like you're doing something worthwhile if you get credit for it. And let's finish that statement. And if you do not get any credit, let's not even call it credit. Let's just call it acknowledgement back, right? That you've even done something. So Does that make the thing less worthwhile?
No, but it doesn't feed your soul.
So it doesn't feed your ego as much. Feed your ego.
But it also may actually make it less. If people actually don't notice that you're doing something, it may be less worthwhile doing.
You might also be less likely to do it again.
Why is it less worthwhile?
I was going to say, I think it's
okay, let's. Hands up. We'll just go around the two because it seems like there's a comment. Yes.
Is wanting recognition for something that you worked hard on, or not wanting recognition for something you worked hard on, really a sign of humility? To me, humility, like at core, it's about not feeling superior to other people, not feeling superior morally or intellectually or physically or whatever other way. And so... When I think of humility, I don't think so much about, I mean, yes, it can express itself in the way I relate to other people, but at core, I view it as a psychological concept. And one might want credit, simply as a way of sensing that their efforts were worthwhile, right? Be a humble person at the same time, I would think.
All right, so we're hearing a couple of different things. I'm just summarizing what the group, I think, has said. I don't know if the group has said, but ideas that have been presented. One is that the need for recognition might be a product of an ego gone far, or the feeling that you need that. Then we're hearing no, but it might also be a useful data point if you're not getting any feedback for what you're doing, that what you're doing is, in fact, not a very important thing to do. And that's where you're not getting feedback, and maybe you shouldn't do it so much if no one's noticing. Okay. And then we're also hearing that, no, maybe humility is about not feeling superior to other people, morally or intellectually. Those are, I think, some of the things we've heard. I wanted to share something that Alan Marinus, never know how to say it, writes in his book With Heart and Mind, which is a good book on these. Maybe before I do that, I want to add something into the conversation. I think I want to add shame into the conversation. I think that one of the things commonly why people feel that they want acknowledgement, maybe I'll speak from personal experience, is if there's a sense of inner like shame or self non-confidence, as it were, in general, meaning if you have a general disposition not to trust yourself, which I think a lot of people feel in some either deep-rooted way or temporary way, there might be a feeling, yes, that I need external recognition as a source of self-worth.
I'm just saying the lack of confidence, but I'm just saying the shame part.
Well, I think like some people, I'll give an example. I was meeting recently with someone who had unfortunately been abused as a child, and they were describing to me a feeling whereby they never felt good about anything they did because they always felt like they were just inferior. And so for that person, they were having social troubles because they were like constantly trying to be better than other people. But really that was a way for them in their own description of it, of healing their shame, that really it was just because their parent in that case was an alcoholic who beat them. Maybe that's an extreme example. That's why I wanted to add that in, is a possibility of where humility could kind of get lost, which I think brings us to our intro essay, I think. And this may clarify, and it'll, I think, bring up some of these themes. So a volunteer to read. Page 54. Page 54 in the pamphlet.
I'm happy. What image comes to mind when you think of a humble person? I imagine an unassuming, quiet person who holds himself back and doesn't take up a lot of space. A humble person could never be a leader of a company, organization, or movement. In English language, humility is synonymous with the word meek. However, Jewish understanding of humility is more complex. The Torah calls Moses the most humble person on the earth. Immediately, we understand that humility does not imply taking a back seat and letting others lead. After all, Moses confronted Pharaoh, led the Israelites out of slavery, and challenged both God and the people at moments of crisis in the desert. Jewish definition of humility is something akin to healthy self-esteem. All midot exist along a continuum. For example, apathy and uncontrollable rage are the extremes of a continuum where patience and appropriate anger sit in the middle. True humility occupies a middle space between self-deprecation on the one hand and arrogance on the other. Before I learned this, who's writing this?
This is Rabbi David Jaffe of Sharon, Massachusetts.
Before I learned this Jewish perspective, I had thought of myself as humble because I didn't think so much of myself. I remember being surprised when a good friend said she thought I was arrogant. How could I be arrogant, I wondered, when I felt so unworthy and low? Indeed, it is just this lack of self-worth that fuels arrogant behavior. During the same era of my life, I moved to Boston to work for a nonprofit organization. Someone held the department director level job and I wanted at this organization. So I took a more junior position. I felt bad about being in what seemed to me as a position beneath my level of education experience. On one of my first days on this job, I asked this department director how long she thought she would be staying in her current position, because I thought her job was perfect for me. Only later did she tell me how arrogant she considered my question. This question was clearly fueled by how negative I felt about where I was in my career path. In this situation, true humility would have meant knowing that I had the ability to shine in whatever job I held. Practicing anava would mean I would trust myself and God that I had something meaningful to offer exactly where I was at that moment in my career, and ultimately, I would get to where I needed. The following two examples of humility in Jewish sources illustrate the point. In the Talmud, Rav Huna says, anyone who makes a set place, a makom for his prayer, the God of Abraham helps him. When he dies, it's said about him that he was an anav, a humble person, a chassid, a pious person, and one of the students of Abraham, our ancestor. What is the relationship between making a set place for prayer and anava?
So before we answer that, maybe let's open that question up for the group. Don't read the answer, because that's his answer. I think this is an interesting question. So you understand this story, it's one of the sources for it, the Makom Kavua. And actually, the source is particularly interesting, I always like to point out. So in this example, it is the moment after the destruction of the home. And it says, Vashkem Abraham ela makom asher amad sham, that Abraham got up to the place that he had prior stood when he was fighting with God about destroying Sodom, righteous people, not righteous, you know the story. And so it said he went back to the same place to talk with God. So the Talmud learns from there that you should establish a place to pray. And I think many people might be familiar with the custom of makom kavua, of always praying in the same chair. Sometimes this gets taken to an extreme when you walk into a synagogue and someone says, hey, that's my chair, or get out of my seat, or move, or does something more violent. And so anyone ever experienced the other end of that, being asked to leave someone's seat? Yeah, so a couple of nods, definitely been there. So the Talmud then says, anyone who does this is a humble person. So the question is, what does setting a place for your prayer have to do with being a humble person? Because a lot of times in context, it feels like if I have a space for my prayer, that would be like a sign of chashivut, of importance. This is my spot. And usually when you have a designated spot, that's a little, we think of that not as humility, but a little more the opposite, maybe.
But if we think about it sort of colloquially, if somebody said to somebody, you should know your place. That's not a, aren't you fantastic? That's, you know, get your act together and realize, you know, who you are and where you are. You're not so, cautious, you know. You should know your place.
How about if your place is in the back left corner? If you set up your makom kavua in the back left corner.
So you're saying your fixed place could be like left field, so to speak. Could be like,
I mean, not. It's different if your fixed place is like on the front row, you know. Mm-hmm. Could be I'm up front. Uh-huh. Like, what if you fix a spot and it's like, you're over here?
Not every fixed place is equal.
I think that maybe what he's getting at is if you have your own place where you pray, whether that's
a location or a seat or whatever, you're kind of learning a pattern through repetition. And that puts you, like Michael said, in your place. Everybody's got their own place. And that when you are in your place, you're not stepping on other people's places. So you're not coming in and telling people how to pray in their area. You know, you have your own set place. You know what you're doing. And that's the norm, but that's also not almost invading into other people's places of worship.
Ah, so it's with the relationship to other people's spaces. If everyone has an assigned seat and no one has the same seat, then everyone can fit in the stadium nicely. All right, I volunteer to continue reading the essay.
So what is the relationship between making a set place for prayer and anava? Dr. Alan Marinus writes that the main issue regards space. When we say that this seat is mine, we're also saying that other seat is not mine. By making a set place, we're also giving space to others. According to Marinus, this is the key to anava. The anav knows how much space to take up in any situation. When our anava is out of balance, we take either too little or too much space. Think about yourself in different situations. Do you tend to speak first in meetings or groups? Do you speak several times before others speak at all? You may be taking too much space. Or do you tend to hang back and not talk at all? Or says anything just before the discussion ends? You may be taking too little space. Practicing anava, our goals are, one, to be mindful of our tendency. Stand or shrink in such situations. Two, to cultivate awareness in every moment of how much or how little space we are taking. And three, to inhabit an amount of space which is appropriate to each situation. Questions for consideration?
Okay. So at this point, I think we're going to break, maybe just because we have, I don't know, we could either break up into small groups for these conversations, or we could do one large conversation. What do people prefer? All right. So we're now in the taking space section, which is, I think, probably relevant to how a lot of us often feel in even a forum like this. You could probably note the sense of, do other people really want to hear what I want to say? Do I want to share? A lot is involved in that. So the first question, anyone could share, what is your relationship to taking space? I'm just going to remind people for these sorts of things, we'll ask for people not to judgmentally comment on other people's sort of statements, but just kind of like share from your own perspective that thing and accept that lots of people are going to have different sort of perspectives and relationships to this notion. Does this even speak to you? Is this something you've thought about before now? Do you have something concrete about it? Yeah.
When I think about this, it actually feels like it's like, I feel like actually it's probably true for most parts of my personality, but it's like goes in both directions. I think that's partly that, like maybe the one you were talking about with humility, that there's like the shame you react to with like being like aggressive. And so I feel like there's part of me that's like very cautious about like making too much noise or, you know, not disturbing anybody or not like causing any trouble. And then in some ways, probably like a reaction to that. Like there's times when I like really want to play my music loud and like be a troublemaker and disrupt the system. And so like that those things are kind of like nested in me simultaneously, I guess. It's hard to know like when which guy's gonna show up.
Yes.
I feel like it's situational a lot of times. In certain situations you're more comfortable being alcohol.
Can you just speak a little louder so the people on the digital could hear? Sorry.
I feel like it's situational. In some situations, you're more comfortable sort of being part of the whole and playing your fair share of the game. And other times you're like, no, not this time.
Why not this time? What are some?
Well, either because you're uncomfortable because it's you feel inferior, you don't have the knowledge, it's too loud, and you don't want to yell out above. You know, there's all kinds of reasons. But if you're not comfortable, you're just not, you know.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So I'm hearing like a security piece to it.
No, I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're with your family or a close friend, I feel like I take up a lot of space and I let them take up space. And, you know, maybe with someone who works for me, I probably take up too much space and don't listen enough. But yeah, big groups or, you know, like some people are very comfortable just taking space. But in big groups where I don't have familiarity, I'm usually not. So maybe that's common for most people. So it's like it is an interesting concept because it is extreme. I think in big groups for me, I think for big groups I'm familiar and actually don't take enough space and probably too much, you know, maybe it's on like my parents or something. I probably take up too much space, you know. Or maybe it's just right for that kind of situation. But yeah.
Yeah.
I think for me, because I live in two different worlds, I'm definitely the person that will take up very little space in a situation like this. But most of my days being a leader, and I take up a huge amount of space. So I don't know if that is kind of what makes me do it, or just my unfamiliarity of what's going on, and I like to kind of observe just to make sure I'm on the correct wavelength.
Anyone else?
Yeah.
Yes.
Things shape up or shape up.
That's not the question. The question is, what is your relationship to taking space?
Taking space. Well, I take space, and I like to have like more of a space.
Okay.
I have someone in the car. I have another person.
Didn't Donnie call you?
Yeah.
He told you we're not doing tonight, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Good. second question then, and the people spoke about this a little bit. So in what ways does the space you take up depend on the situation? So some people already started to express this notion of like, well, some situations you're supposed to take up more space or less space. Yeah.
I think me personally, I tend to not step into other people's space. So even if I feel like sometimes mentally in a situation where I feel like I should say more, I start. But that's just the first.
So can I ask a question? Whenever I hear this discussion, I sometimes feel like it's not related to the things that matter. Like a lot of times taking up space is about feeling like you're doing more or less than other people. And I guess what I want to add here is, could it be that, let's say you're working in a work group and everyone in your work group is mediocre. They have mediocre ideas that are likely to fail, but you are in fact brilliant. And your ideas are likely to shine, but you want to only take up equal space. And so you let in what sense might this be related to ability, and how good a judge are the corollary question then is, should this be related to some kind of like ability as opposed to some abstract notion of equality? I guess maybe those are two of the frames it could be on, right? Like, I don't want to speak more than other people in the group. That's an equality sort of consideration versus ability. The people that have the most to contribute should be doing more or less. I don't know if anyone wants to comment on that.
So I suffer from that. I think is that like it's just easy to do it myself. Just do it myself. Like when you include other people and they don't do it the way you want it done, or they don't do it like fast enough, or they don't do it that way you want them to do it, then I fall into this pattern of saying, well, like I don't then include other people, but that's not really very good. So
what is that not good?
Well, then I end up doing everything and then I get resentful when I'm doing everything. So and it's not a good leadership model. Right. It's better to be, if you're in a leadership model and you're doing something, you want everybody's vision, everybody to feel invested in what's happening. It's like your event, everybody's event.
So like I struggle with that balance.
Ah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, so part of humility might be the realization that even if we could do it better, we ought not do everything, or that it's okay if some things don't get done perfectly.
Right.
Which is hard, especially if your name is on it. Or
I think
your...
there's a, like a tough, there's a very like fuzzy line that's drawn in one's desire to take up space and one's ability to understand how much space should be taking up. Right? Say you're like, say you have all the good ideas and all your team members don't have the good ideas. You have to be able to, if you want to ideally help the group, you have to be able to take up more space, but know how to do that right. And the way that you say things could really make a difference.
So could you say more about that? Like, what's the right way to do that?
Well, the right way to do it would be, I don't know. I mean, it depends on the situation. It depends on how helpful everyone else is. But everybody really, the better of the group will result from you taking up maybe the space of some others. The best way to do it would be to take up that space, but in a manner that doesn't make those people feel like you're taking over, which is very fuzzy, very hard to do.
Yes.
Sometimes I think what you're speaking about is helping guide rather than dictating, helping guide, helping draw people out, throwing things out for them to look at, to chew on, to think over. And see if they have an investment toward any of the things on the table without making them feel like they're idiots because they didn't think of it first. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Thinking of that scene in My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Right.
Where the people know this scene where the wife wants the husband to come along with an idea that he doesn't have. And so she engages in an elaborate ploy to make him think it was his idea. That's an exaggeration of it, a comedic exaggeration, but sort of what you're saying.
I don't mean necessarily making
right.
Yeah, but throwing out things that will draw them out and chewing on an idea and talking about it so that they have an involvement.
Allowing other people in.
And an understanding, and then they can make a decision about it. If they don't have an understanding of it, it's kind of hard to make a decision about it, you know? So teaching is part of the process of teaching without putting somebody down, you know? And accepting that it may not be perfect in the end. Mm. Which is the hardest part.
I was thinking back to, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu being our sort of model of things, and I can't remember, as I think through the parsha, I can't remember any time where it said Moshe Rabbeinu saying, "All right, guys, what do you think?" That wasn't
twice he asks for help, right?
Yeah, he does.
For judges.
Yeah, but it's Yisroel pointing out that you should have judges, and so and he says, "All right, I get it, I'll get judges." But it's normally, you know, it's normally him saying, "Listen, the way that you kind of take." It's not kind of ego invested. He says this is the way it should be. I've been talking to the big guy, and this is the way it is. And it's not. It doesn't sound like anybody's put down. But when it comes to Korach, Korach's pretty well put down. You know,
so yeah, he's very
clear. So so sometimes I wonder. You know, when we think about something, I'm thinking in a way back to Moshe Rabbeinu. Like, what would he have done if, you know, in a situation where these things that we're describing sort of come, or things that I would imagine Moshe Rabbeinu doing. And then I wonder for myself if I'm not close to that. Like, am I somehow missing it? You know, one of the things it sounds like there are elements of, let's say, being like a humble leader in sorts. You know, and like, let's say a group dynamic. You might be invested in sort of a group itself, sort of growing as a group. In which case, this notion of sort of sitting back and getting help and soliciting. You know, on the other hand, you might be very focused on the goal. And group dynamics, cute, but it's not. You know, it's not. But that's not where you're at. You're after a goal of achieving something. So,
I think a good example, actually, from yes.
I'm thinking that for me, humility has a lot to do with respect, showing, allowing, giving yourself respect, and then allowing people to have the respect that they need to say what they have to say. So I'm thinking Moshe Rabbeinu really was a zealot for God's respect.
It wasn't what forgot
to say? Zealot for God's respect, right? He wanted, you know, but Korach, like, you know, God had to sort of get his respect, and Korach wasn't going to do that. Mm-hmm. So, and I And I think for me that has a lot to do with group dynamics too. That, I mean, at least for me, the goal isn't who's got the best idea. It's that did everyone have a chance to express their idea in the way that they felt respectful.
Respect.
And that there was space for that. Respectful space for everyone to participate.
But in the situation you laid out, one person's got the brain, the rest are sharing one, right? Are you going to let them drown? So, but it's the two sides of it. You help
but you
people
don't really
come
know
along.
The ideas oh, yeah. are not good, so everyone has a chance to express them, right. and everyone can
but
then
sort
of.
I think
that's
line.
But that's the hard part.
That's
finding
the hard part.
That
where's
line.
That line? Right.
How do you express to them while also letting them feel expressed?
Right. Is it an us and them dynamic? Maybe that also might be something to think about. You know, like I was thinking a lot with the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur about the goal is to all feel like we're dancing in a circle. We're all in this circle. So there's nobody up there, nobody back here, and nobody's better than anybody else. We're all equal. So I think when he talks here about the continuum and that there's humility or there's something that's in the middle, there's something in the middle here between deprecation and arrogance. So find that in all these different situations. But at the end of the day, I think we all want that middle place and we all want to be in the circle.
Yeah.
Oh,
what's up? No, that's fine. What's your name and then Karen?
In my mind, Anava is really connected to the Hitlam Dut that we did, that we talked about last time, and the stance of feeling like always being in a sense of openness and like there's something to learn. And so even in the sense of like talking about like others on the team or in the group as like if they have a chance to express themselves or to respect it, but actually feeling a sense of like they may actually have something that I can really learn from, something to contribute, which is like a whole other level of just sort of like allowing them to like speak or express themselves or respect it, but actually, you know, I could really learn from them.
Right.
You know.
I mean, that's an interesting question, right? Right, but the practice would be how many times are we in a group that we come in with an idea of what's going to be the best thing and other people are saying some other thing and we're like, okay, that's nice. Yeah, say your thing. And we're just like disregarding what they're saying, basically. Because I'm back to the... Karen.
So I've been thinking that maybe humility has something to do with vulnerability. Like if I don't feel vulnerable, then I'm not I'm not taking up space in a way that is properly humble. And the reason I was thinking that was that all the examples of talking about group dynamics, you know, I can make sure that everybody is sort of quieting down enough to hear folks who haven't spoken yet. And that creates a kind of vulnerability because there's the uncertainty about what's going to happen and whether everyone will contribute. But there can also be a way of holding forth and contributing that idea that you know is good, but you do it in such a way that it's not overbearing, that you still have a sense of vulnerability even in the process of taking up space. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Did you want to ask a question, Alyssa?
No, I didn't hear it properly.
Karen was saying that there's something related to vulnerability there, that if we enter into a group dynamic without feeling, tell me if I'm saying this wrong, Karen, vulnerable in a certain way, then we're not taking up space. It's not just about taking up space or not, but there's a quality to the space we take up, which is, I think, the idea emerging from several of the comments, right, which is that it's about engaging with people and being open to them and putting the idea forth for them in a way that invite, right? There's a certain way in which we can be genuinely interested in others and not so consumed in our ego or not. That's, I think, what we're beginning to hit at. And I think Moshe is an interesting example because there are two episodes that I want to draw attention to in his life. One is where there are two people in the camp, Eldad and Medad, and they are also having this ecstatic prophetic moment. And people come to Moses, I think, assuming he's going to be upset at a perceived rebellion that other people are prophets and are prophesying, they're saying the word of God in the middle of the camp. And he has an interesting reaction, which is, it would be wonderful if everyone was a prophet. Right, so that's an interesting, like, he's surprised that people, or seems surprised that people are angry, and he welcomes their prophecy. And another example is when his sister is telling gossip about his marriage to someone not from the Israelite tribe, when Miriam is gossiping about him, and God wants to punish her for it, he prays on her behalf instead. So I think both of these examples are related in some way, I don't know how, to the brand of humility that Moshe has, meaning a bold leader who doesn't really take consent except when his system is so broken that he like can't bear it anymore, on the one hand. But on the other hand, is welcoming of other people's genuine religious experiences and forgiving even of personal attacks against him. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it speaks to exactly the point that there's times when we stand up for values and we're not afraid to speak up and not afraid to take up space and be a leader and be very forceful and assertive. And then there's times when it's personal sort of compliments or that we sort of say that's fine, you know, we don't, we're okay, we don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's times when we feel it's absolutely essential to speak up. I think the distinction is when it's speaking up for something, truth, values of something, and not for personal, just personal gain.
Ah, so, okay, so a distinction between like the idea or the and just like a personal slight or standing. Yeah.
I guess I just want to raise that I think it's very complicated to try to use Moshe as a reference point, because he's like been given like leadership by God over a number of people, like a peoplehood, and so it's really confusing for me to try to like, say, well, how does that apply to me? It's so I. Not that there aren't like lessons to be learned, but it's so.
Moshe, the divinely appointed greatest prophet that ever lived, is hard to relate to in that way because most of us are not given that kind of autonomy.
I mean, if you think about it, though, he was chosen to be a leader of a lot of people who, a lot of them probably thought they had good ideas too, right? So the way that he led, I would focus more on the way that he led as opposed to him just comparing myself with him. Right? Maybe look up to the people that he led instead, but see how he led from a point of anava, from a humble perspective, as opposed to being like, oh, I was trained, so you have to listen. I don't know if there are examples of Moshe's acts from stories or whatnot.
I think it's a great example because it does show you how you can be a great and powerful leader and be humble. And there's just not a lot of examples in modern society of that, you know. I mean, even if you look at Israel, the early leaders, a lot of them were, you know, demonstrated humility much more so than today. It's, you know, in so many countries, the politicians are not, they're going to be that way. And why there's so many problems, you know, there's not a lot of humility in leadership.
So let's turn to a different example then. This is good. All of this is good. And maybe brings us to Abraham, a different perspective. Who would like to read that? A different perspective. Sure. In the page 55, middle of the page.
A different perspective on Anava involves our ability to show up as needed in any particular situation. When God calls Abraham at the beginning of the binding of Isaac's story, when the angel calls to Moses from the burning bush, both respond, "Hineni, here I am." An ancient commentary to the Torah says that Hineni implies anava and readiness to take action. What is humble about saying, "Hineni, here I am"? When I can declare, "Here I am," when my mind and body is fully present in a particular place and moment, I set aside what I might have thought was important in favor of something else that is calling me from a deeper place. Abraham and Moses heard God calling. What is the equivalent call for us? As dedicated as I am to spiritual life, I've never heard or a non-embodied voice call to me. For me, the equivalent of a biblical call is deep. For many of us, it is hard to tell the difference between intuition, the general voice in our head. But when we can discern our true inner voices, the challenges becomes putting up our other priorities aside and declaring, "Inani, here I am." To do so takes conviction and deep trust in our spiritual lives. This inner confidence is also a representation of Anubha.
So we'll open this up as a different model, and maybe getting at what you were saying a little bit, even with Moshe, of Hineni, of like bold leadership being a sort of form of Anava. So can you remember a Hineni moment, a moment where you sort of like felt deeply called to do something, but maybe there was like conflict about it, either inner or external, or obstacles, or it was hard to want to do that? And you said yes, or also a moment when you did not say you might have done that, but didn't. I'll add a moment when you said it, but then learned you shouldn't have said it. It's another possibility. You thought you were called. I've experienced that.
I mean, it seems to be very similar to the concept of the choice point, because it's about listening to your intuition versus what your feelings. You know, that it's hard to tap into your intuition and follow it always. You know, it's about also making the choice to connect with your intuition.
You want to think of a moment. It's interesting to say this as we would often consider this the opposite of humility, but like here, this is the Jewish definition of humility also, as part of the taking of space, is when you really chose to take the space you spoke. If I was trying to square the models.
The Hineni moment, like you're called to do something?
Yeah, like in this case, Abraham, the Akedah, right? So he's about to bind Isaac, and it's just, he's got to really go in on that, you know? Kind of good for the high holidays, because the thing that the cantor opens with for Musaf on the high holidays is often Hineni, here I am. And it's funny because then it comes with poor and unworthy, but it starts with here I am.
Well, it's kind of necessary, that ability to say here I am, whatever you need. You have to sort of like suppress your own needs, your own desires, the contraction to be like, you know, whatever you need, God, or like to pray, you know, on behalf of the community. I think there's like a connection there.
You're describing like a little bit of a paradox, like in order to be fully present, you need to like suppress yourself a little bit.
You need to right.
Do they have to be like momentous events?
No. Yeah.
I think as a parent, you do that all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're often taught to be present and step up at our own expense oftentimes, or at the point of decision, what's good for me, what's good for the child.
Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily take it as here I am, like I'm gonna totally like ignore the things that I need in order to take in for another. I see it as like, here I am as I am. Like Abraham maybe saying it like, here I am, like, I don't really want to do this, but I'm here I am. I'm this imperfect person about to do this thing that I don't necessarily understand or agree with. But here I am anyways. And I could think of 1,000 moments when I've come not at 100% and said, here I am, like trying to do my best. I feel like that's the connection to the humility part, is sort of recognizing where you might actually be sort of weak or imperfect in some way, and still sort of showing up, if that makes sense.
Part of me thinks that the that it's hard for me personally to feel, if I'm calling something, to separate out aren't I cool that you called me? In that group, yeah. You know? And so, you know, if it's a very menial thing, I remember years ago, in Washington, whatever, it was really challenging. And I had somebody who was a physician. He said, if I can help you with anything, call. I needed a flat tire fixed, and I called him. I thought, this is stupid, you know? But I called somebody who had like a million things to do, said, could you get the flat tire fixed? Now, that person said, you bet. Now, that I thought was a different thing than say, you know, would you take on the notes, whatever? Because I said, pretty cool, you know? And it's hard for me to separate out those, but sometimes I do feel I'm glad I happen to be in a situation where I'm with help, and I'm aware of feeling, boy, it's a privileged spot to be that I just haven't been there. You know, separating out, putting back the ego. It's still hard. So.
Yes.
So, point of clarification, there's something that confuses me about this whole, I guess the definition of humility that he offers, that it's somewhere between it's that sweet spot between deprecation and arrogance. That seems wrong to me. It seems to me that the Jewish understanding, I mean, I'm not saying I'm right, but based on what I know, the Jewish understanding of humility is actually much closer to deprecation. I mean, right, like from dust you came until to dust you return. I mean, it seems like the whole idea is that compared to God, we are nothing. And so many of our prayers are kind of oriented toward conveying that idea. Seems like actually true humility from a Jewish perspective. I'm not saying it's complete deprecation, but it's like it's much closer to that than arrogance.
We have two pockets though. Mm-hmm. And in one pocket, on the one hand, we're nothing, we're dust. On the other hand, we're
So like, this is that story. Okay, good. So I'll say a word about Jewish perspectives on things. It's very hard for there to be a Jewish perspective on a thing because a lot of the PU team and the prayers were written by people in particularly in the High Holidays in the Ashkenazic Pietist, Yehuda Chassid and his students. And they lived in Northern Europe at the temple of the mid 12th centuries. And they had a brand of Judaism that, for example, I was just reading about their ritual. You know, there's this ritual of Hatarat Nedarim, of before Rosh Hashanah, annulling vows you might have made. So actually they originated the text. They wrote the text for the that we, and I recently decided to look at the original text. So it has all the things we say, if I promise to do something, etc. You know, let it be null and void. If I incurred any penalties, let it be null and void. If I made any vows with the name of God, let it be null and void. And then it goes on. If I did anything that made me liable to be subject to a death penalty by burning in Jewish law, may this candle that is burning my flesh atone for me. You get the sense they were burning themselves. And if I did anything that I incurred a death penalty by choking, may the two people choking me now atone for, and I realized, oh, they were gathering and choking each other and saying like, here's a little bit of atonement. And then everyone sat for 10 minutes in excommunication, ripping their clothes and covering themselves in dust and ashes in case they incurred a penalty of excommunication. And so that was a Jewish view of atonement, was like, burn me and whip me and choke me and stone me and then maybe I'll atone. Coming out of a particular Northern European, I don't know, academics could speak about what influences that had on other cultures or Christians in Northern Europe. You know, I'm sure there's some, but in the Musar tradition, the Musar view of humility is really more about these sort of Tupac. So people may know the story of Simcha Zissel, the original story. It's told about many different people. That he used to have a note in each pocket, right? And one it said, Anochi afer ve'efer, I am but dust and ashes, which is from Abraham in the Torah. And then in the other pocket, a statement from Pirkei Avot, from the Ethics of the Fathers, Bishvili nivra ha'olam, the world was created for me. right? And so the sense in that sort of story is that humility is about the sweet spot between Anochi Afer Ve'efer and the world was created for me. So the only thing I'm going to add to that is I think they're both true, right? Which is like that's it, right? We are going to return to dust and ashes, but like also the world only exists from our own perspective and like seize the day. You've been called, you know, you're here, you were created with intention. So I think Jewish humility is about sort of balancing our temporality compared to God. And that's something that the prayers often remind us of because our ego often lets us think that we're like gods. But the Musar view is not to go only to that extreme because we might not do hinani. We might not do what we're called to do. So I think it is, I don't know if I've clarified anything.
Don't you think this, from here, the example has to do with some sort of sacrifice called
Right. Right. Okay, good. So even Hinani here is complicated because it is Abraham being called to be present with conflict, imperfect, likely doubting, to sacrifice his progeny. So maybe you're assuming that it includes it all, kind of. It's his own
stream.
Okay, maybe I'll just conclude with one passage about this, and then say I'll suggest a couple of focus phrases for this. One that a lot of people like these days, very popular focus phrases. Not less than my place, not more than my space.
What's that?
That's from Dr. Alan Marinus. Not less than my space, less than my place, not more than my space. As an interesting sort of focus phrase. Another possible focus phrase for this unit could be hinani or hinani. And that focus phrase could have different, could have like a different sense at different times or for different people. It could be a question, it could be a statement, it could be a statement of doubt or a statement with confidence or a statement of inspiration. Hinani, here I am. Am I here? another possible one that I sometimes think is related is who is wise, one who learns from everybody. It's related to Hitlamdut, but it gives us the sense about, hey, if I think I'm so much better than other people, which is related to humility, but I'm not really listening to them, well, a wise person isn't someone who knows it all, it's someone who learns from everyone. That is sort of a blur of Hitlamdut and humility, but that shows how the midot can kind of blend together. Those are three possible, but you can choose any phrase you want. I throw those out there as suggestions.
Does the phrase change after every lesson, or should we, is it kind of
like? So I'd like for people to, you can change the phrase as often as you want, but this is going to, so long as it serves you.
Ideally, though, we want to be focusing on the particular lesson.
Yeah, so this will be like a month-long phrase, ideally. But if you find that like it's not working for you, you want to change,
sure,
do that. And for Kabbalot, for an action step, I don't know if any of them are emerging, but another phrase can be, wait, why am I talking? Which can be an interesting one. Why am I talking? Wait. For Kabbalah, I'll never speak at this. I never say anything. place at work and it's a meeting and you don't actually say what you think, don't get fired over it. You can be done. But maybe you're going to say something honest that you really think or try and contribute. Or maybe you feel like you're doing too much speaking and crowding out other people. And so you're going to only speak after everyone else has had a turn already. Right, you're going to wait for everyone to get a turn before, I don't know. Or they don't have to relate to these things, but these can be the sort of kabbalot you might take on. And it should be something that ideally happens every day or at least regularly so that you can do it. And it shouldn't be so hard. It should try and be at your choice point where it's challenging enough that it pushes you to develop in a different way, but it's achievable. Does that make sense? It shouldn't be so easy. Your Kabbalah shouldn't be like really easy for you to do. You should have to like, should be discomfort, mild discomfort. So maybe we'll close with a Talmudic joke. Let's see if anyone laughs. Says, actually, at the very end of, there's a Gemara where at the end of this Talmud it lists when this person died, this ended, and when this person died, this ended. Anyone remember what it was? And it lists like 50 different sages. When this person died, this ended, etc. So it says, let's look at where it is. When Yehuda Nasi filed the mission, anava, humility ended. That's interesting in and of itself because he was pretty, wrote down the oral law. It's the oral law, not written. And he wrote it down so it would be safe. And that is humility. The law. So that's interesting. So Yosef comes and says, it's not true. It's not true that humility ended when he died because I'm here. So the Marsha there says it's bidichusa. It's a joke. It's a Talmudic joke. But the Netziv of Tal Tzvi Yehuda Berlin said, no, it's a lesson about humility. Here's Rav Yosef saying, no, humility is not done. And you can, it's not, in other words, humility is not self-deprecation. And in fact, that's the lesson of Yehuda Nasi. It doesn't have to be deprecation. It has to be being fit to the moment, as it were. So there it's not about, you understand, it's about sort of knowing what the moment called for and knowing how to do that in a way that worked. And I refuse to submit to the idea that humility is dead. And I can call myself humble. It's okay. Kind of a thing. So I'll leave you with that. thank you for laughing at, according to the Marsha, at least the Talmud's finest joke. And I thank everyone for joining this session. We will create, just to follow up, a Google group. If it does not happen tomorrow, it will happen by Friday. And for anyone who will, if your study partner is here, you might want to find a time to rendezvous with your study partner. If not, speak with them and see if you can find a time that works to check in. And at your check-in, you want to do a little bit of what's your focus phrase? How's it going? What are you working with here? What's your Kabbalah? What's your action step? And also the sources in this unit. There are many, many sources that we've given, primary sources, beginning on page 57, that you can learn in depth. So it goes from 57 through 66. So from the Torah, from the Talmud, from other things with discussion questions. So that'll kind of guide the chavruta a little bit. And then you should feel free to share on the Google group at any point. Also, you might want to reply, I'm keeping a chart of them. I can share them with the group if people want, or if I should or not. Focus phrases in Kabbalah. Maybe we'll take a vote. Do people prefer I share your particular Kabbalah with you, or is it better if it's your own thing so that you don't have to like share what you're working on with everyone? Yeah. Let's do that. I'm seeing a lot of nodding. People should feel the comfort to take on things they want to take on, and so maybe we won't share those with the whole group. If you want accountability, you can let me know what it is or not. Okay. Thank you all, and wishing everyone a Gemar Chatima Tova. Everyone should be sealed for good things, and hopefully Tikkun Midot will help carry the spirit of the high holiday season past the high holiday season. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. So,
okay.